I met Andy Zofko about a year ago down in Roswell, New Mexico. I happened to be down there when he was invited to Assumption Parish there, Father Bill McCann. Actually, that's where I'm staying right now for a period of time. And I was so impressed with Andy that I thought, well, we want to get him at Pecos. And so I called him sometime after that, and he was very gracious. And so the time has finally come. And so Andy is very special, especially used by God for spreading the messages of Our Lady, Medjugorje, and a very special gift of healing as well. And so we're in anticipation of the wonderful work that God will do through him. I hadn't met Father Becker, but we chatted over the phone a number of times back and forth, and we finally met this evening. But he, too, he's from the Archdiocese of Chicago, and he's very active in spreading the messages of Our Lady there and various parts of the country. And so we're very pleased, very blessed to have them with us tonight and this weekend. And so we want to pray for each other that we'll all be open to receive all that God wants to give us these days. So Father Becker, do you want to start off here?
Okay, or sure. Thank you, Father Andrew. My name is Father Charlie Becker, and like Father mentioned, I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of Chicago, and the Blessed Mother has brought Andy and I together some years ago now. We've been working together for about 15 years, and after our Blessed Mother brought us together. But I'd like to kind of share a little bit about how that happened, and Andy's gift has certainly taken him to many parts of the world and many trips, and it's such a special grace from God. And through the intercession of the Blessed Mother, we have so many graces working in our world today that is a great help in this time of confusion and darkness and even apostasy in our own churches and parishes, depending on where you all hail from, what kind of difficulties you may see or have had to encounter. The Blessed Mother arrives on the scene in a special way when her own shepherd sons, priest sons, are not fulfilling the work as faithfully as they ought. The heart of the mother gets nervous, see, gets anxious. So she intervenes with the permission of God the Father to help draw her people back to her son. Well, part of that too is sometimes the sons need to be brought back to the son. So Blessed Mother takes care of her priest sons too. And sometimes we have expectations of the priest to be where we would expect them and like them to be, and oftentimes might find that they're not. And that confusion that has permeated the dioceses and the world has been going on for some time, actually throughout all of history. But in a particular way, a lot of the confusion was brought about after Vatican II, not because of Vatican II, but with certain theologians and philosophers that like to kind of take it and twist it and interpret it the way they like to interpret, which has brought a lot of confusion to many of us in the church over the last several decades, particularly. So I grew up mostly in the Vatican II church. The last time I recollect seeing anything that was much like the Latin Mass of old, the Tridentine Mass, would have been first grade. So after that, that was the end of it, you know. I mean, I grew up in a pretty much of a progressive parish in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. At the time, it was considered an experimental parish, whatever that meant. We were the experiment, though. And I thought it was kind of exciting in a way because, you know, everybody seemed kind of up and excited about it, particularly some of the priests. And there was also a lot of rebellion against what I understood was whatever the old regime was. You know, there was something new on the scene, and so people were kind of excited about that, even though some of that newness was probably misunderstood by those promoting it. So that's why we have this confusion of the day. So I grew up in that climate where it was one of the mottos was pray and play was this particular parish's way. you know. That was the spirituality, okay? So it was a lot of party, a lot of good times. And the spirituality, there was some spirituality there that was and one particular priest I was enamored with. And but as the years went by, I could see where you know, we can have a certain spirituality individually growing in our lives, but it may not always be hooked up too well with the teaching and the mind of the church and the expression of how the way the church desires us to express our faith, which keeps the unity. And so sometimes we see these liturgical practices that oftentimes are kind of coming from left field. And so today, hopefully, there's a clearer understanding of what we're supposed to be about. But that also has to resonate with a faith experience in our heart, huh? And in our soul. So we can have all of the doctrine and we can have all the catechism. And, you know, for many years now, we've been, our young people have grown up without catechetical background. And that's been unfortunate, you know. However, and that was done in favor of having some kind of a spiritual experience or religious experience, like in a retreat setting for kids, okay? So they're getting kind of the faith experience in the heart, but not being able to match it up with some kind of catechetical foundation. And that's what the last 30 years, particularly, our young people have missed out on. So you need both, you know? You can't have one without the other. I think in the earlier church, in the old church, before Vatican II, it sounds like, and I wasn't from that, but there was a heavy emphasis on catechesis, which I remember in my early grade school, you know. It got to the point where they just kind of chucked all of that, which wasn't good, you know. There needs to be a proper balance of all of that, right? So it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Plus the climate of the 60s and all of that in the church was a kind of a certain attitude of rebelliousness from the get-go, you know. It was an anti-establishment in the country and the Vietnam War, and so it was kind of just, you know, to be anti-authority. So it was kind of popular in the priesthood and many priests to just be against authority too. So kind of that's what we're doing these days. And so people would kind of go off on their own and kind of develop their own theologies. And also at the behest of some theologians in Europe, some of these errors crept into the church, particularly from Germany and from Holland and Belgium. Some of those seats of theology that were a little bit, well, what would they call progressive, whatever that's supposed to mean, but people who are putting their own spin on an understanding of the Vatican II documents. So we have particular theologians like Hans Küng or Ed Skillebeck. And here in the United States, maybe Karl Rahner, too, to some degree in Europe, but also in the United States, Richard McBrien at Notre Dame and Charlie Curran. And so it got very popular to follow those kind of guys. And then what got translated into the seminaries was their thinking. And so we have generations now of priests raised with this kind of rebellious thinking, okay? And I was raised in this seminary system that was pretty liberal, if you can use that word, because it means a lot of different things, but, you know, in that kind of progressive attitude. And it matched the parish experience I grew up with and the local Catholic high schools, and they were all feeding off one another and keeping this kind of attitude that wasn't real good with the church going, with the proper understanding of Vatican II. So, after 4 years into the priesthood, with a number of things going on in my own personal life, so we have the personal spiritual life going on in our heart, and then we have the catechetical piece that's probably missing for many Catholics today. And so as I come out of the seminary system, I'm pretty much mixed up on the theology, and my spiritual experience, though, has been pretty good. I rediscovered, in fact, 3 years before my ordination that I was an alcoholic, okay, and that was in my family system. And so I looked forward to being able to have the program back. It was like, wow, because I had it in Alateen growing up as a teenager. And so then my own drinking years and first year of Mundelein, the major seminary, I finally, the light bulb clicked, and it was always a prayer of mine in high school that I'd be able to recognize my drinking, if it ever became a problem, that I'd recognize it earlier in my life rather than later in my life. So that was one of my prayers to God. Because I used to say, in an alcoholic family, you're either going to marry an alcoholic, you're going to become an alcoholic, or both. I'm like, ooh, that doesn't sound so great, you know? So I started praying then, you know, I'm like, okay, God, you know, if this happens to me, help me to recognize it, because I don't want to go on blindly for many years, as many alcoholics can, you know, stay in denial with this. And then my other prayer was that I could be a social drinker the rest of my life, okay? So you want to have both going there, just in case, you know, because drinking was a good time, you know. Okay, so anyway, my finally, after ups and downs of that throughout college years particularly, and I won't go into all of the details of that, but I finally acknowledged that as a problem in my life and got sober my first year at major seminary. So all through the seminary, I had this renewal of the program for me, which was really my spiritual foundation. But again, it's not Catholic per se, and I wasn't making a whole lot of sense out of my Catholic priesthood part, the priest part, you know. I knew I was called to the priesthood back in high school. I knew that from the Lord. Growing up with the background I couldn't always make sense out of that. Growing up in the culture, and particularly today, kids growing up in the culture today is even worse, you know. I can't imagine if they're floundering how to make sense out of the priesthood in this kind of crazy culture if you don't have kind of a subculture of faithful Catholic spirituality holding you up. Okay, so that faithful Catholic spirituality didn't come my way until I went to Medjugorje. And my first trip there was 4 years into my priesthood. And I was at a crossroads in my priesthood. I was ready to quit, and only 4 years into it. And it was because I was like, I couldn't make sense out of it. I couldn't make a deep enough meaning out of the spirituality of the priesthood. It was like every Sunday we were having the masses with the people, and we were in a parish of about 2,500 families, and it was a pretty good-sized parish. And I'm like, I know the people out there are hurting. I know, but we're not getting at the real needs here. Oh, we can have nice parties. Oh, we can have great parish picnics. Oh, we can do all of that kind of stuff. It's like, how do I reach the people? I thought I'd be better off as an alcoholism counselor and at least help that population and help people really get at some of the concerns that are in their life than the priesthood. I couldn't make sense out of this, the priesthood part of it. So, and then the other issue, I thought, well, either it's the work and the vocation of the priesthood that's the problem, or it was the lifestyle. Maybe it was the lifestyle. Maybe it was the celibacy thing. Maybe that was the problem. So I was frustrated with the celibacy lifestyle and the work, vocational work of the ministry, not being deep enough or meaningful enough. I'm thinking, well, that's two major parts of your life, your lifestyle and your work, and that's your life. So if that's kind of messed up, I mean, what? So I felt like I couldn't stay, but I couldn't leave because so much had gone into my becoming a priest, and so many people were behind it. And I know the Lord had called me to it. I was like, what's missing here? So at the time, Cardinal Bernardino was the diocese, the bishop in Chicago, and I'd asked him for a leave of absence. And he says, well, I would hope you wouldn't leave the priesthood. And I said, you know, I really don't want to, but I don't know what else to do. I just feel like I need to take some time. And what I was going to do was train in alcoholism counseling. So it's kind of like at least subconsciously getting ready to leave, make sure I got a job. You know, so you're just kind of thinking down the road here. So, and it was a field I'd been involved with before, some years before. So I began that training, and as I began that previous 6 months prior to this, I'd gone on my first trip to Medjugorje, and it was a family in the parish who asked if I would like to go, and I had watched a couple of families in the parish who had been there. And they came back with certain fervor and a zeal for their faith. They wanted to know more about their faith, you know. And they would just ask questions, and they were just kind of like on fire. One family in particular were a middle-aged couple, and their kids were all grown. They're all in their 20s, except one 7-year-old bonus baby. Okay, so there were five young adult children, and this one second grader. And every month, once a month, this dad would have all of his 20-year-olds lined up for confession. I'm like, wow, that's no small feat. I mean, hey, you know, if you're a little kid, maybe, but 20-year-olds, kind of interesting, you know. Every month, because most of the time you sit in the box for an hour and nobody comes around, except I knew this family would come around once a month, you know. Otherwise, it's pretty quiet in the confessional box these days. Partly it's because priests aren't encouraging it or reminding people what sin is. I've seen some of the, I was just reading an article yesterday of a diaconate program up in Joliet that was espousing the fact that, well, this is a quote of one of the teachers or something in this diaconate program, had said, well, it's finally the church came around to understanding that the only mortal sin is abortion. That's the only one left, you know. And even that's questionable because people may not have the right intention. And that's all goofed up, see. They're still teaching things. And this is the diaconate program, okay. So there's still weird stuff out there. We all know that. So where was I going after that? I got a little mixed up. The family that took me to Medjugorje. So they would come to confession and they would explain a little bit about their experience. And some people would talk about Medjugorje by saying, they're fanatics. So I'd kind of like watch to see if that was fanatic. I even looked it up in the dictionary. What's a fanatic? You know? And the dictionary says, you know, a fanatic is somebody who forces their agenda. So it's different. Somebody who's excited about it and somebody else who's imposing it on you with almost force. That's a fanatic, huh? Okay, somebody who won't let you go if you don't believe their way. That's fanatical. But to be an excited or to have a fervor about something you've discovered and you want to share and you want to grow in it, that's not fanaticism. That's excitement. You know, that's a good thing. It's like Andrew going to Peter and saying, look what we found. You know, we found the Messiah, you know. I don't think they label Andrew a fanatic, you know. Okay, but he was excited about this gift, this grace. So this would go on for a few months. And finally, this one father asked me if I would like to go to Medjugorje after Mass on one Sunday. And I thought, well, I didn't know about that. I thought, you know, why would I go 6,000 miles for a spiritual experience if God could do something right here in Chicago or in Lake Zurich? Why doesn't he just do it here? I couldn't make any sense why I go all the way over there. Because I was used to some spiritual experience in the program and God's grace touching us, and it just didn't make sense that you'd have to go that far. He says, well, you think about it. I'm like, think about it. I thought I just kind of told him I don't think I'm too interested, but I said, well, okay, whatever. So he walks out, and I was thinking, well, he'll forget, and he won't ask me again. 2 weeks go by, and he and his wife come by again, and his wife is very unassuming and mild and calm and gentle and quiet, you know. And he's very gregarious and bold and in your face. So he says to me, hey, Father, have you thought any more about that trip to Medjugorje? I'm like, I don't think so. I said, I still don't see why I would need to go that far. He said, well, we'll pay for it. I'm like, well, then my own pride got up. Well, I can pay for it myself, even though I couldn't, you know. But I thought I'd tell him that, you know. I said, well, no, that's not that. Will you think about it? Think about it, you know, just leave me alone, you know. So he leaves, about 2 more weeks go by again, and he says, Father Charlie, have you thought any more about that trip? I'm like, oh. So now his wife is making eyes. He's pushy, you know. And I said, I really don't think I'm interested, Casey. He says, and he was like 6'5", and he's about 280 pounds. You know, he says, look, he says, I'm in sales, and I ask 3 times, and on the 3rd time, I don't take no for an answer. So I'm kind of like, well, I guess I'm going to Medjugorje then, huh? He says, you'll go? I go, well, I guess. He says, can we shake on that? I said, well, if you go with me. He says, well, I wasn't counting on that because I don't know if you could swing all of that. But he and his family, some of his family went. And so he shook. He says, wait right there. And he runs out into the parking lot, and his wife is just quietly watching all of this go on, you know, up against the wall watching her husband. And he comes running back into the church, into the vestibule. He says, now you said you'd go, right? And I said, yeah, I'll go. He says, well, I just told Jane, and she's the mouth of the parish, and it's all over the parish that you're going to Medjugorje. So it's like they wanted to clinch this thing, you know. And to get a priest to go was, a big fish, you know. I didn't know anything what he was doing. So we're all set to go, okay. And about a couple months later, off we go. And now I have no clue about Marian devotion. And the last time I prayed a rosary was probably third grade. And there was another priest who was leading this trip, thank goodness, because I didn't know what I was doing. And I was never in my blacks back then. I was in my blue jeans and my Nautica jacket, and I had a little long hair on the neck to be cool with the kids, you know, and smoking my cigarettes still, you know, and that's kind of the scene, see? So we get in the van, and we're driving to O'Hare Airport, and he says, Father, he says, now, what do you think about this trip? And he's got this little microphone with a tape recorder, and he sticks it in my face, you know? I go, well, I don't know. I said, you know, I'm looking forward to this trip. You know, I said, just so nobody talks about any of that Fatima stuff. He says, would you say that a little bit louder, Father? Because I had no clue about Fatima, or I didn't know what all of it was about. All I remember was that the little old ladies, after morning mass every day, would pray that the messages of Fatima would be heeded. And I'm like, what are they talking about? You know? Let us pray for the conversion of Russia. And I'm like, what about the conversion of America? You know, I didn't get it. I didn't know anything that they were talking about. But I think those prayers helped move me along in this thing that's unfolding in my life. So we get to Medjugorje. And so, you know, there's all this talk about signs, you know, and everybody's looking for signs, you know. Did you see the sun spin? I never saw the sun spin. And did you see the cross spin? And did you see your rosary change gold? And all this stuff, you know. So you're kind of keeping, you kind of don't want to be too curious about this stuff, but then on the other hand, you kind of are, you know. So I remember having some of that skeptical attitude or cautious attitude that perhaps was instilled in me from the seminary to just be careful of different things or test it a little bit or whatever. And I remember almost like a certain Protestant notion of like, don't go to Mary, you go right to Jesus. It's kind of like, why do you Catholics go to Mary? And some of that must have rubbed off on us Catholics, seminarians too, is similar, because there was no devotional life in the seminary of the rosary. We never had adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, none of that. You know, it's just kind of dry that way. It's part of what we've been going through the last 30, 40 years. So I'm looking around the town just kind of for what's the focus in Medjugorje. Is it on Christ or is it on Mary? And everywhere you look, everything's marked out with a cross. If you walk up the Apparition Hill, everybody's leaving little crosses on the pathways and with prayers for loved ones. And, you know, it's all directed to Jesus. There's the big cross up on Cross Mountain. You look around the parish church. There's all these lines for confessions, which is the sacraments and the Eucharist, and it's all about the Mass, and it's very Christocentric, we say, you know. It's all about Jesus Christ. Blessed Mother's just bringing us to her Son, and that's just what her role is. And Medjugorje was an expression of that reality. So I thought, well, it seems safe enough. Whatever I thought was not safe was safe. So we began to, you know, meet some of the visionaries in Medjugorje. And at the time, it was still 1989, so it was communist. And the officials of the area didn't want groups gathering around the visionaries. So we weren't allowed to meet with them. But there was something in my heart that desired to be around an apparition, not necessarily right with the visionary in the moment, but near it. But we couldn't be on that first trip. So we would listen to the visionaries outside their homes recount their experiences with the Blessed Mother, which were really beautiful, and they would describe how she looks and that she can touch them and that they can touch her, and then some of the messages, you know, the basic messages of Medjugorje. And there was one particular incident that first trip. There are two also what they call locutionaries, two young people who hear the Blessed Mother. They don't see her, but they hear her either in their heart, which would be an interior locution, or audibly with their ears, but they don't see her. And these two were younger than the other six visionaries. they began getting these locutions when they were 10. So here we are now at 17 years old or 18 years old, and these kids have kind of like been raised by the Blessed Mother, you know, since 10. And so they really are a peaceful young people. And I remember being at one of the gatherings with them and kind of this disgruntled American mom who raised her hand, had a question, and they asked her, and this mom kind of went on, or this woman went on and said, "Well, what does Our Lady have to say about our kids today with all of their drugs and their rock music and all the difficulties that they have?" It was kind of said in a snotty way like that. I'm like, what's her problem? You know, she's got an attitude here, you know. So I watched Yelena, you know, just respond. The question was asked to Yelena, and Yelena responded in a very even, calm demeanor and said, "The reason why our young people are having such difficulties is because of the lack of presence of their family, of the parents." And I'm like, wow. I thought no kid could kind of put that right back on a parent in such a calm way. I thought, for me anyway, it was a moment I thought, something's going on here. Something special is going on in this town, you know. So we went to Father Yozo's church. He was the pastor of the children at the beginning of the apparitions, and everybody would make a trip to listen to his reflections on the gifts that have been happening in Medjugorje, usually for an hour or two talk and some prayers. And during the talk, and again, I'm walking around without my collar. Nobody would know that I'm a priest. And this man and wife who took me over to Medjugorje, the wife was standing outside the church, and I went outside for it's probably a smoke break now that I think about it. But anyway, I went outside, and this mom, she says, "Father Charlie," she says, "can you smell the roses?" And she's making a face like this, you know. And I'm like, because I wanted to, you know. I said, "I think I can." She goes, "Either you can or you can't." And I'm like, I'm not smelling what she's smelling, you know. So I went back into the church, you know. I thought, get away from her. So I go back in the church. So now Father's praying over people and they're resting in the Spirit. And I'm like, oh, what's that, you know? I haven't seen that. I was never in the charismatic renewal or anything like this. And I'm like, I don't know if I want any of that. Well, the dad, he wants that. He wants some of that, this big six-foot guy, you know. And they said, "Well, what do you think it is?" I said, "I don't know. I've never seen this before." So we're standing up against the back of the church watching all of this go on up at the front of the church. So I said to one of his daughters, she had some problems with her feet or something, some infection or rashes. I said, "Why don't you go up and see if it gets better, and then we'll follow. Kind of like test this thing, see what's going on, you know." So anyway, we all went up, and his wife felt the Holy Spirit rested in the Spirit. I rested in the Spirit. The daughter rested in the Spirit. The little second grader rests in the Spirit. The big guy who wants it doesn't rest in the Spirit. So we're watching, and he was kind of disappointed, and we're watching all these people falling on the floor, and it's what it is an experience of peace you feel when somebody has this gift of the Spirit to pray over you, and it's kind of whatever God is doing with you. So we, not knowing anything about it, the dad, you know, leans over to this one gal who's laying on the floor for about a half an hour, and he turns to me and says, "Father, come over here." He says, "Look at this." I go, "Yeah, what?" He said, "She's been down for a half an hour." I go, "Really?" He says, "What do you think it is?" I go, "I don't know." He says, "Is it jet lag?" I said, "I don't know what it is, you know." Then we're like looking at it, and realizing later on, you realize these people can hear you. This is the English group. This lady probably thought we were nuts, you know, talking, "What do you think it is, jet lag?" You know, thinking, who knows what the... So we walked to the back, because we don't know what we're doing. Okay. So that was kind of the first trip. Now, I wasn't going to go back to Medjugorje, and the second trip came 6 months later, that same group that took us... Oh, and before the very last day of that last trip, we're standing around, the priest who led the trip wanted to say little goodbyes, and we'll pray at last rosary together in Medjugorje. So we do a decade by the cross. We do a decade on the steps of the church. We do a decade here, a decade there. And the last couple decades we do around the Blessed Mother statue. So we're standing there in a circle. And we're praying a rosary. And we're, for some reason, Father and I were right across from each other. He says, "Father Charles." And I'm like, oh, no, he's going to ask me to lead. a decade of the rosary, and I don't know the decades. I know my Hail Marys, but these people, especially the little old ladies, are going to gasp when they hear, I don't know what I'm talking about, you know. So I'm thinking, would you lead us in that fifth sorrowful mystery? And I'm like, oh, and my two friends weren't next to me. They were in the circle on the other side of the circle. I couldn't go, what is that? So I'm thinking now, AA, I'm thinking 12-step program would say, you know, honesty. You know, how, we got to be honest. How can we know that there's a problem unless we're honest, okay? And the problem is we weren't brought this stuff up in the seminary, and people got to know what they got for their money's worth in the seminary. Here I am, you know. We don't know our rosaries, okay? So I just looked right across at him, and I said, and Father Ken, just what might that be? With a, you know, just kind of hold my breath, you know. He said, the crucifixion. I go, the crucifixion. And I do my decade, you know. So that's kind of where I was at. And I tell that story because, you know, many people don't know their rosaries today. You know? Most people don't. So it's like, I can point the finger. And, you know, I was a little frustrated and angry when I came back from that first trip. Because I'm like, what happened? Where did this all break down that I don't know this? And that my pastors don't know this? And that, you know, things are all a mess. I was a little frustrated. And about that aspect of it. And to some degree, still am a little bit. But then on the other hand, it's like, oh, we can look and point fingers forever. The bottom line is, pray our rosaries. Let's just get back on track, learn our faith, and let's just do it, you know? And that's what's happening. Our Lady's just picking up where there's been all of this lack of faithfulness and attentiveness to the prayer. Huh? So that was the first trip. So the second trip, I go back with that same couple, same company out of St. Louis. And they said, would you take a group for us? And I thought, well, I have never done this before, take a group. What do you mean, me take the group, you know? So I said, if you guys come with us. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll come. And then at the last minute, they said they wouldn't come, but they were going to send a new rookie gal who just started in their office, and she'd come with me. Well, it's like, well, that's, how good is that? She's never been to Europe either. So off we go, and all I'm basically doing is what I did on the first trip. That's all I know. So I'm just going to repeat what Father Ken did. And so the first day we arrived, and I knew, I had heard that there people were gathering around the apparitions at the bell tower. And I knew I needed to be, I felt like I wanted to just be near an apparition. So we get into town. I told the group that I was with, and many of them were members of my parish. I said, look, I don't know what you guys have to do, but I know what I have to do. I said, so we'll see you back here at dinner. Okay, bye. I run out the door with a couple of my friends and go to the church and sit on the steps under the bell tower and pray the rosary because the apparition happens while we pray the rosary between 6 and 7. Apparitions at 6:40. So we're praying and praying. And I feel this peace like a blanket. It was like a blanket of peace, if you, I don't know how else to describe it, come over me while I'm praying this rosary. I'm just so into it. It was beautiful. I'm like, I've never prayed the rosary. Because I wasn't praying the rosary after my first trip, actually. I still didn't get it. I didn't get it. See, it takes the priest a couple times to get it. Took this priest 3 trips before he got it, okay? So the second trip, so praying the rosary. So the rosary's finished, and one of my friends says to me, you know, that lady that's walking over there was trying to get your attention. I go, oh, she was? Yeah, she even tapped you on your shoulder. I said, oh, she did? Yeah, you were really rude. I go, oh, I was? Because I was like, I was just into this piece, you know? I said, okay. So, and again, I'm still not in my collar. This is 6 months later, second trip, still in my blue jeans. Here we go. So I come up to her. I said, excuse me. And she doesn't know I'm a priest. I said, did you want to speak to me? She says, well, yeah. She says, during the rosary, I got the sense I'm supposed to tell you something. Well, I get nervous about these types, you know, because everybody's got something. Oh, yeah, somebody's got something. I'm like, oh, yeah. I said, like what? She says, well, are you confused or undecided about something in your life? I'm thinking, well, that's like a horoscope. Everybody's confused or undecided about something in their life. But in my life, back in March, I really suppressed the whole celibacy issue. I just crammed it down. I was finished. That's how I was going to deal with it. I'm just, you know, not going to deal with it. It's like, that's how it's going to go away. And the other thing I was thinking, well, cigarette smoking, but it can't be about cigarette smoking. I'm thinking this in my head, you know, cigarette smoking, it can't be cigarettes. Just ask her what it is and get this over with and see what she has to say. So I said, yes. She goes, well, I got the sense I'm supposed to tell you It's going to be all right. You're going to make a decision. It's going to be all right, and you're going to find happiness. I'm like, oh, that's nice. Thanks. You know, whatever. So I told my friends, okay, let's go. We got to get home, back house for dinner. So we get it, walk across the plaza, get in a taxi cab, and I could smell the roses really strong in the taxi cab. I'm like, my gosh, this taxi cab driver has got a spray of roses on the back. I turn around, there's just this stinky leather coat laying there. I'm like, man. And then one friend gets in the front seat of the car. She says, can you smell that? I go, yeah. I'm like looking for an air freshener. She says, there's no air freshener. Like there'd be an air freshener. It's still communist. So communists don't have air fresheners, you know. So another friend comes in the back and says, can you smell that? I go, yeah. She says, make room for her. I'm like, what? What do you mean? Slamming the doors, we're driving off and we're smelling these roses for about a good 3 blocks, you know. And just carrying on. I don't know what the taxi cab driver thought we were. Must have thought we were nuts, you know. So we get home, and the next day it had rained a little bit, and I told everybody, I said, well, we'll climb Cross Mountain and we'll pray the Station of the Cross. That's what they do here. And then at the top I'll hear confessions because that's what Father Ken did. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing what I saw done before. So we do that. We start, but it had rained, so it was only half the group because it was slick going up the hill. We get up to the top. I hear a few confessions. And the last person, who was a young mom in the parish, and after the confession, she had shared with me, she said, oh, Father, she says, I've had 4 dreams about you. I go, oh, really? 4 dreams. Okay. I said, well, what's like that all about? She says, well, the first dream was you were just there. And I remember her calling me when we were in the parish before we left for the trip, and she said, well, my husband's concerned that there's war breaking out in Albania. It was just beginning in 89, 90. But I was told that that's far away and it's not Medjugorje and don't worry about it and we'll be fine. She says, so I was just kind of thinking that's what that dream was. She said, but the second, third, and fourth dreams have happened since we've been here. I go, really? She says, well, what? And she says, well, the second dream was you were there again in the dream just like you were the first time, but this time you were helping me counsel me through something or talk me through something. And after her confession, she had shared with me the reason for her coming on this trip was to pray for her 5-year-old, I think it was a nephew, who had some kind of congenital heart problem. And she just got a telegram that he died that day, see? So we were kind of like talking about God's will and death with children and this kind of thing, you know, kind of difficult conversation. But anyway, I kind of figured what that was about. I said, well, what was the third dream? She says, the third dream is you have to quit smoking. I'm like, what? She says, I said, well, and in my mind I'm thinking, well, God will have to do something. I've had the teenagers in the youth group keep track of my cigarettes. We've all done all chewing the Nicorette gum. I've tried it all. I said, I don't know, God's going to have to take care of it. I'm done with that. What's the fourth dream? I don't even want to talk about the cigarettes. You know? What's the fourth dream? She says, well, the fourth dream's more personal, Father. I'm like, really? She says, well, it's kind of hard to talk about. I'm like, well, go ahead. You know, what was the fourth dream? She says, well, are you confused or undecided about something in your life? And I'm like, my jaw hits the I'm like, yeah? She says, well, in this dream, you're going to make a decision, it's going to be all right, and you're going to find happiness. I'm like, no way, you know? I'm like, this is 1990. I've heard of, like, prophecy in the Old Testament, but this is weird, you know? So I'm, like, really freaked. I start running down the hill to go find my friends and tell them, look what this gal just told me. And her name is Mary, by the way, of course, you know. So we're running down the hill. I said, you know, and I recounted what she said about the decision. And I failed to mention, in the taxi cab when we're smelling all those roses the night before, my one friend says, well, what did that girl want to know out in the plaza? I said, well, she wanted to know if I was confused or undecided about something in my life. I don't know. She says, well, what do you think it means? I go, well, probably my celibacy or vocation. Well, if that's what you think it is, it's probably what it is. I go, well, whatever, you know. So coming down the hill, I run into them again, and I said, the gal said the same thing that the other gal said down on the plaza. And so my friend says, well, did you ask her what it was so that you could confirm it? And I'm like, no. I said, but we're all going down to lunch. I'll ask her when we go down to the restaurant. So I pulled her aside. I said, Mary, I said, in that fourth dream, I said, did you have any idea or sense of what that confusion or indecision was about? She says, oh, Father, it's very personal. I said, Mary, this is my dream. What was it? She says, well, does it have to do with your celibacy and your vocation? I'm like, oh my gosh, you know. So I'm like, now I'm walking around Medjugorje. Bless the mother. You're here. You have my life. What do you want? You know, how can anybody know this stuff? You know, so that was basically that trip. And the next time we were to get together to go to Medjugorje was a flyer, one of Andy Zavko's flyers, was circulating around these new prayer groups that were just being established. And and the sheet come across the front of my face, and I looked at it. It's a very simple flyer. It's of Medjugorje, the price, you know, his name, the phone number, that was it. And something in my heart drew me to say and know that I don't know why, but I'm supposed to go on this trip, which was only 6 months later. Now, that would be October 90. So I'd been October 89, May 90, and now it's going to be October 90. And so I called up Andy, and again, some of the same friends that have gone on those previous trips with me went again, and that began our encounter. At this kind of crossroads in my life, I had been working now because Cardinal Bernardine let me have a little bit of this leave so I could train in the addictions field, which I was doing. And what happened then was I consecrated myself, because in these prayer groups that were being established in that previous summer in this man's living room who took me to Medjugorje, we had a statue of the Rosa Mystica, and it was exuding the scent of roses. And there was another statue of the Rosa Mystica, which was apparitions of the 1940s and 60s in Italy, that cried in Chicago in 1984. And so we were allowed to have one of these statues at the establishment of the beginning of this prayer group in this man's home. And we were, again, smelling these roses and having an experience of a tingling of the Holy Spirit and not knowing what these things are, reading the scriptures, opened up to the scriptures, and read, just happened to fall on Peter's discourse on Pentecost. And so these things are happening, you know. Then the healing gift, a healing gift began to happen, as because this man, again, who took me to Medjugorje, said, Father, there's a prayer group we also had in a church, and he said, Father, would you pray over the people as they come up for a prayer, like they kind of do in Medjugorje, you know? And I said, sure, I guess, you know. So they're following communion lines, coming up single file line, and I'm just blessing everybody with on their forehead with some oil, and not thinking too much of it, you know. And all of a sudden, I feel this, and it was wrapping around me. It was swirling around me, going on, and then I'm like, oh my gosh. And the lady that was right in front of me, boom, hits the floor. I'm like, so now I look up to the ceiling of the church, and I said, God, in my own mind, knock this off right now. That was my reaction. I'm like, I'm just getting used to this Blessed Mother stuff. I don't want this Holy Spirit stuff with, next there'll be tambourines and all of that, and I don't want all of that, you know. I thought, so God doesn't care what I think, right? So it didn't happen to anybody else, but the guy who runs that prayer group who took me to Medjugorje saw that happen. Aha, because that's what he always wanted, right? So we're in his living room in his prayer group that following week. He says, oh, Father Charlie. I look over at him. He says, would you pray over everybody after prayer, after the rosaries tonight? I'm like, oh, I know what he's looking for, you know. And I'm like, oh, here it comes, you know. So I said, well, yeah, what am I going to say? No. So I pray over everybody, and about half the people in the living room are laying on his living room carpeting now. I'm like, oh, my gosh, what are we into, you know. And then I had tried sharing this with the teen program at the parish, the teen youth group. And they all rested in the Spirit because they're even more open because they're kids and it's just vulnerable and open. And now I'm nervous because I don't know what's going on here. And the kids are nervous that I'm nervous. Well, Father, is this okay? And I go, yeah, I think it is. I said, it's good. It's peaceful. It's good. I don't know what we're doing here. And then it kind of moved into praying before the Blessed Sacrament. I'm just kind of feeling my way. I would just kind of make it up as I go. I brought the Eucharist out of the tabernacle and just set it on the altar, and we sat on the floor and prayed, and because we had no background on doing any of that, you know, like adoration and all. So that was kind of the beginning of it, and as I consecrated myself to Her Immaculate Heart, I finally said, and this was my consecration, on my way to work at the drug treatment center one day, I said, Blessed Mother, I said, I'm sick and tired of trying to figure out my priestly life, my life in general. I said, as long as I'm alive on this earth, You have it. You do with me what you want. You just use me the way you see fit. And she took my life at that moment. I know it because it was another mystical kind of thing that began happening in my life through a different friend of mine. And that pointed the fact of the Blessed Mother forming me or reforming me over the next 10 years in the Chicago area. But and in that, which I'm going to tell a little bit more in a second talk, another probably tomorrow morning, I'll go into that a little bit more, of the consequences of all of this. Because, you know, the devil doesn't like this, and he's going to attack this, because this is going to make a difference in his church, you know, in God's church, and Blessed Mother's church. And so for the sake of the talk right now, I'd like to give it to Andy, because it was at this point in my conversion that Andy and I met, and then we began working together ever since. So here I'm going to switch the mic over here, and then Andy can tell a little bit of his experience and story.